tip the scale. Just remember that, then.
There's a small bit of a needle there.
Now, come on, Mayo, you've got to get Andy Moran into the game.
Listen between them.
When we left you on Christmas week, Dublin had just been crowned All-Ireland football champions in an empty Croke Park. The country was lurching towards another COVID lockdown, and it was already becoming clear that no football would be played for a long time. Here we are in the week after Easter, and there hasn't even been a legal training session yet, let alone a match. Here's a promise, though. This podcast will not be about when teams will play again or about what the format of the league or the championship will be. We're going to talk about football. So hello, everybody. You're very welcome to the Irish Examiner Gaelic Football Show. My name is Paul Rouse, and I'm joined by the former Armagh footballer, Oisín McConville, and by Eamon Fitzmaurice, one of a very select group of men to win All-Ireland Senior Football Championships as a player and as a manager. There's no football, but there is a football story. Oisín, what did you think when you saw the story of Dublin training last week in Inishfail's GAA club?
I was hoping you wouldn't come to me first, because I was hoping to get a feel for what was going on in the room before I would get a chance to speak. But I've been, I suppose, already on the record about this, in that people are obsessed by the optics and how this looks, and I'd be more interested in the substance behind it and why Dublin would take the risk of going out and training. And I think there's a couple of things about this that are pertinent before we... I think Dublin were wrong, and they deserve to be punished because they broke the rules. But I would like to take it back to the fact that our elite athletes at inter-county level were elite athletes 5 months ago, and they're not anymore. I would have an issue with that, and I would have an issue with the way that that was communicated. I would also have an issue with the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, all teams should be back on the pitch. So from juveniles right up to inter-county players. I'm not going to get into COVID. I'm not going to get into the science or anything else, because it can make myself very quickly look very stupid. But I don't think that, you know, when I hear people talk about shock, horror, disappointment, like, I don't know what it was like for you guys, but when I was in trouble at home, which was quite often when I was young, the one thing I hated to hear was, I'm disappointed in you. I'd rather get a cuff round, like a good bashing, rather than somebody tell me that they were disappointed in me. And I suppose I was never in doubt that this was going on behind the scenes. 9 lads on a football pitch in Dublin, kicking a ball around. When I think of the things that they have been deprived of, when that particular age group have been deprived of, and I want you guys, before you come back at me, because I know you are, before you come back at me, think about what you were like between the ages of 18 and 28, how you would like to be cooped up. Most of these guys getting college whipped from under their feet, no social life, a lot of them walking from home, no social interaction. And and for me, when people talk about the vulnerable in society, I think of the kids, and I think of these guys, young adults who are suffering as much as anybody else. So that's my take on it. Obviously, as I said, they were caught, and I'm sure punishment will be meted out. Very cute of the Dublin County Board to get out in front of this and ban Desi Farr. But for me, these guys should have been allowed to train anywhere, and we've just created a rod for our own back by not allowing them to do that. So that's my take, right? You can come back at me now.
Amen.
Yeah, no, look, I'd agree a lot with what Oisín had to say there, but I think they're two separate arguments. I just think that, undoubtedly the challenges around COVID and everyone being cooped up, you know, there is a valid point in that, but I think every branch of society have their own challenges at the moment, and everyone can make their own arguments as to why they could bend the rules or make up their own rules. I just felt from the Dublin story, there was two things that I took out of it. The first thing was that I felt from their own perspective, it was unnecessary. I don't think that a team that are after winning six All-Irelands in a row need to be getting together late March, early April for the upcoming season. I presume that they've been doing a lot of individual S&C work, fitness work, all that kind of stuff to be ready for the pitch when they get there. And it'll be a matter of getting their football up and running and getting that back up to the levels of sharpness that they'll need it at. I thought it was arrogant of them to just go off and have a session like that, particularly when, you know, the new president and the director general had come out with a statement the night before about that we had to adhere to the rules. Because believe it or not, Oisín, I do think a lot of counties are adhering to the rules and are, you know, not doing the collective sessions. And I know Kerry aren't, for example. You know, I just think that when you're doing the thing right, then you almost feel like a bit of a fool. You're looking around and you're saying, geez, the best team in the country are getting a jump on us. And to use your word, I do think it's this, and I think it's disappointing, not only from the Dublin perspective. I think that all inter-county teams have a responsibility to lead by example and, you know, not to be trying to cut corners. It's one thing cutting corners when it's GA rules. I don't like that anyway. But when it's, you know, when it's around the COVID situation, when there are so many people that have been affected in so many ways and are so frustrated by it, I think this, I just think it was a bad call. I think in terms of it, and you mentioned it as well, Oisín, I think the Dublin County Board were clever. They were well advised. They came out. They didn't say much. They said enough. They banned Z-Far. And the response has been muted enough in the meantime for what is a huge story. And I think when you look at some of the other, you know, the Cork story in particular, I think when that broke last January, I think there was much more of a furore around that. I think when you look at other things that have happened during the COVID situation, like Golfgate and things like this, there was much more of a furore around it. And they have been clever in basically trying to bury it. But for me, there remains two outstanding questions. And that is, number one, were there other groups training around the capital that morning? I'd be surprised if it was just nine players that are all living fairly close to Inishfails that were training. And number two, then, is there going to be, you know, more of a response from the GA? Are they happy with the response? And how long has it been going on for? Because if this is something that, you know, that has been going on for a month or 6 weeks beforehand, I think it's an even more serious situation than if it was just the first morning of it and they happen to be caught with their pants down the first morning. Well, that's a different situation then.
Yeah, I think I agree with bits of, or a lot of what both of you are saying. I take your point, Oisín. I think people should have been in the field training. I think it should have been facilitated. I do believe that it's exceptionally difficult at the moment for people in their 20s, and I understand the drive of inter-county players, but I will say straight out, when I saw the story, I was absolutely raging. I was just raging about it, because if you're involved in a team in a Dublin GAA club at the moment, you are repeatedly receiving reminders by email that of the restrictions that are there, that club facilities are closed and that we are not to organise training. Indeed, a message was posted on the Dublin GAA site the day before that to remind us of all of those things. And then the Dublin senior footballers were engaged in a training session. And I understand why Dublin fans are defending the team and the players. And I'm not understand why they try to dismiss any criticism of this as hysteria and that it's just a whinge and kind of a bitter boggers. I think that's the nature of loyalties. And I do also believe, by the way, that all across the country, there are club and county players who are meeting up in threes and fours, doing their running, kicking a ball around and doing stuff like that. But this was different and it had all the appearance of an organised training session. I believe that it was a pod. It looked to me like a training pod. I think it does matter if there were training everywhere. And it's not just a couple of lads kicking a ball around. We can't describe it as this. We've been told for a long time how brilliant the Dublin training sessions are. And are we now supposed to describe these as just lads kicking the ball around? And if it doesn't give a team an advantage to train collectively, then why would you do it at all? And I do think there are serious questions for Dublin County Board. And the answer isn't an easy one here for them, because if we are to believe that nobody in the county board knew this was happening, well, what does that say about how the board is actually run in its own way? And where there are there employees of the county board involved in the training of that team in any aspect? Did they know what was going on? Are they party to all of this? And I thought the statement issued by Dublin County Board was really interesting. It was so short. So the point it said, following an investigation this afternoon. So that's how long it took to work out what was going on. But what exactly was it that they found out? They said it was a breach of COVID-19 guidelines. Well, it was also a breach of the rules of the GAA, not just COVID-19 guidelines. They say it's COVID-19 guidelines. I say it was a breach of the rules of the GAA. And they refer to a serious error. And I think it does matter how long they've been training. And I was very taken by the words of Paul Curran, the Dublin former Dublin footballer, who said it was hard to believe, to use his phrase, that it was a once-off. And again, I'm not interested in players getting suspended. I don't care what bans are in place, but I would like a good look in the report at what exactly was happening. I think that matters. Again, not interested in suspensions or whatever, but I do think it does need to come out. What would you be doing if you were training Kerry at the moment, Eamon? What would you be doing? What would you be doing with the players?
I think my attitude at the moment would be that you'd be, and it is, like Oisín said, the natural instinct is to be out in the pitch. But I think taking into mind the situation we're in, I'd be trying to make sure that everyone was absolutely peak physical condition when the green light was given. So that when you got back training, your sole focus was football. Getting the cohesion back in your play, getting the spirit built up, getting ready for a series of matches again. And I think as a group, if you're coming back and you're completely physically ready, that's job done. That's job done. You have a pre-season of work done. You're ready to go, looking forward to football, and your sessions are totally around football and football-based. And the S&C gang are in the background monitoring the fitness levels to make sure that everything's okay, and that's it. I think that would be my focus at the moment. I think also, as onerous as it probably would be, you could be doing some Zoom meetings if you had ideas about different things that you were going to try in the pitch this year. You could have a few clips of video that you'd share with the lads, and you'd have discussions around, and you'd have all that kind of background work done and be ready to go then. That I think that's the way I would be approaching it. You'd be encouraging the lads, of course, to keep up their skills. They'd be doing that on an individual basis, or if there was a couple of them living together for college purposes or work purposes or whatever. And that would be the size of it. And then once, like I said, once you got the green light, you'd be ready to go. And it'll be an exciting place to have everyone actually coming in peak physical condition and just going then and going at the football.
Oisín, do you think it will affect Dublin that Desi Farrell has been suspended by their own county board for 12 weeks?
I don't think it'll affect them. I think the more stick used two boys give them, I think the more they'll use that as time goes on. They'll take it out when it's most needed. I think that they won't be perturbed actually with what's happening on the pitch, because there'll still be that level of communication from the sideline. Desi Farrell's not one of these people who gets particularly animated on the sideline or anything like that. So I think from the practical side of it, I don't think so. And probably when it matters, he will be back in the sideline. But I think,
can we talk about that practical thing for a second, please? And what exactly does a manager do?
Well, a manager has to be across everything that's happening on the sideline, and he has to trust the people he's with him. So I think the biggest job for a manager, whenever you get a job, is to look around you and see the people you have around you and trust the people that you have around you. I think I thought the runner was a very important part of what was going on in GAA, because I can go up the road and I can manage my club team it's very easy to get a message across. But as the competition ramps up, as the crowds get bigger, that message I found through my management career, and one major regret I would have, we played in an All-Ireland club semi-final against Castlebar, And one of the major regrets I would have is that we didn't have somebody in the stand. Because we'd never had anybody in the stand, so we just said we'd continue what we had. And we went to Cavan to play Castle Bar. It was for a club match, there was a huge crowd there. And we sort of got caught up. I thought we as a management team got caught up in what was happening on the pitch. We ended up losing the game, and I think had I had somebody in the stand, then they would have been able to recognise a few things. So I think the people around you are very, very important to you. And then as a manager, you have to realise what your strengths are, okay? And I think if your strength is to call the changes, I think that's probably something that Eamon maybe liked to do himself, was, you know, call those changes maybe himself. But I like somebody around me who is able to detach themselves a little bit from the giving out to the referee, having to go to linesman, fighting with the opposition. So somebody who's devoid from that, somebody who has a very, very cool head in that situation. And that's the people I in your management team, I think it's important to have one person like that, so that whenever, you know, the white heat of battle, that you're able to have somebody there who has a cool, who is cool, calm and collected, and have that head. But your biggest job as a manager, I think, is to put all those people in place before you actually need them, if you know what I mean.
So training starts again, most likely. The manager of the team will not be able to go to training sessions now. He will not be able to go to matches when they start, and he can't go to team meetings. So he will devolve responsibility essentially already. So the manager's job then is to pull everything together. Is that basically it? And he will still be able to do that, though just not be present at the events themselves. Is that right, Eamon?
Yeah, it'll be, look, I think for Desi Farrell, it'll be a blow personally. And, you know, having, he's had a kind of, obviously they won the All-Ireland last year, but from the picture he would have had in his head about what managing Dublin would be, it's been very different from, number one, COVID and the restrictions around that and the way that the championships have changed and everything else. So it's going to be a blow for him personally to have to take the step back, to be removed, like you said, and like Oisín said, he'll still be able to have an influence in the background, and I'm sure everything will be going through him. But at the same time, it is going to be a tough 12 weeks for him in terms of staying away from the group. And when he comes back in, and as he'll find, as in any walk of life, the thing is going to tear off without him. It's not going to wait for Desi Farrell. And when he comes back in, trying to find his way in the group again, you know, could be challenging the initial couple of weeks. But look, he's very experienced, and I'm sure he'll get on fine. In many ways, he's kind of taken one for the team. The punishment that I would have thought would have been more, I don't know, is appropriate, but certainly would hurt the group more, is that when everyone else is back training, if they weren't allowed back train for a week or two, I think that's the thing that would hurt you then, that if you're trying to get a step in everyone else, well, the way to stop you getting the step then is that you're not allowed back training when everyone else is training. But I'm sure I'm not sure how much the top brass would have an appetite for that, or how easy it would be to police it anyway. But I feel sorry for Desi Farrell. I think it's going to be a tough 12 weeks for him during that suspension.
So Eamon, see, when you're making decisions, you know, like that on the lane, especially substitutions, how many people's involved in that?
Yeah, it's definitely a collective thing, Oisín. I'd have always had the management group involved in it. I'd have been on the line myself. I'd have had the Mayor Forna down the line and one of the other selectors, and then two selectors in the stand as well then. So they would have been in constant communication. And I agree with you. I think the selectors in the stand are invaluable. And I think in an ideal world, you'd actually have a selector in the far side to be generally, like if you're in Croke Park, for example, everyone's in the Hogan Sand side of things. And sometimes you see something afterwards and you're kind of saying, You know, if there was someone in the Cusick stand, you get a different perspective from that side sometimes. So yeah, we would have, whichever one of the management had spotted something, we'd all discuss it. The lads would have a chat. One of them then would bring it to me and say, what do you think? Will we do this? Sometimes you'd say, yeah, absolutely. Let's do it straight away. Other times, hold. Other times you'd say, give me a few minutes to throw that around my head. Other times I'd say, I'd come up with something and I'd ask the lads to have a think about it. And generally that was the way it worked. Of course, there was plenty of times we missed things and we'd be watching it back afterwards and we'd be saying, how didn't we see that? Or how didn't we spot that? And there was other times then where it worked well. And it is definitely one of the satisfying parts of management that if you do make a call in the heat of battle and it turns out that it's a good call, it can be satisfying afterwards.
It's that thing in management, that idea of preparation and having plans made in advance, but being able to move them on the day or to do something entirely new on the day. Where does the balance sit between those two things?
Yeah, no, I think you can absolutely have planned a good bit, but you have to be loose in your thinking on the day. Then you can't be bound by what you've discussed beforehand. We definitely would have discussed, you know, we used to call them what ifs, and we'd have discussed them a lot as a management team. And it would have been a case of, what if someone gets a black card early on? What if it's one of the full back line? What if one of the corner back leaks 3 points in a row off their best corner forward? What if we're not winning breaking ball? You know, that we, what if we can't get a grip on their kick out? And sometimes it would be as simple as, well, we'll swap the corner backs. Other times, if we're not winning breaking ball, right, we need to get in and get a message to the players to remind them about their positioning, you know. And we would have thought about things like that beforehand, but then during the game, you have to be open to what's happening in front of you and to be able to react to that. And that's probably the key, if you can get that right. And in fairness to Dublin, and it's one of the things that I thought was a hallmark of Jim Gavin's time in charge, how well they used half-time and how often, you know, that they did make the right decisions as a collective at halftime and get the tide flowing in the other direction for the second half. You know, there was plenty of games where they would have had tough first halves, but they would have always seemed to make the right calls at halftime, and they did it over such a long period of time. You know, it wasn't a coincidence, in fairness to them.
Paul, I think the one you're maybe thinking about is the one I think about a lot in regards to being pre-planned is Colin Boyle one with...
Yes, that's exactly what was in my head.
See, I can even read your mind now. but the Colin Boyle one used to be one that sort of, you know, some days I'd be wondering, how's Colin Boyle still there? And then other days we'd be going, just the last person who can take off today is Colin Boyle. And just at a certain point, you know, I think it was 50-odd minutes? And all of a sudden he was gone, and I was thinking,
a bull tick walking off the pitch. You see him walking off and he's shaking the head and he could not understand, you're taking me out of this.
Yeah, and I think that's where it comes to be just a bit more loose in what you're thinking during games. Have a certain plan. Like, there's always, as far as my limited management experience is concerned, the way I work is I would always have 1, 2, maybe 3 players I'm thinking I couldn't get them onto the pitch because I think they can make a difference. And you're looking at stuff and you're going, you just be amused sometimes by, you know, maybe things are going well and you're thinking, well, how do I get them in? Who do I, am I gonna change the balance of things? But look at the where to go, and that's a lot of the things where I think my weakness as far as management is concerned is maybe not just being loose enough and just letting things sit sometimes, and not being forced to change something when things are actually going okay, you know.
Have you ever given a fella a run and putting him on because you thought, if I don't put him on, I'm actually going to have to listen to this for a while?
No, but I'll definitely be conscious of, especially at club level, of whether, if you don't put him on, whether you're going to see him on Tuesday or not, you know, and trying to keep as many people in the loop as you possibly can. And that's a balancing act. But again, that's probably more, you're more conscious of that, I think, at club level. And I'm not sure if that's the case, you know, as you go up the ranks.
You know, so you've managed Cross Madeleine, and now you're now managing Inniskeen Grattans in Monaghan. What was it like the first time you walked into that dressing room in Inniskeen? What were you thinking?
It wasn't too bad because I had some of the lads at DKT, I'd known a few of them when I walked in. It's about 10 minutes from my house, so I think.
Did you have a meeting, or did you have a training session?
Yeah, no, I met them probably 3 weeks before we trained, before we did anything, because I just felt the need to make sure that everybody was aware of what way things were going to be, and therefore, you know, you had to buy in or you don't buy in. And then from there, just straight into training. And look, at when you first take a training session with a lot of lads you don't know, how am I ever going to know these guys? How am I ever going to know, you know, names and all that there? But just in a couple of weeks, it comes to you, you sort of get a sense of the different characters. Unfortunately, when I took them over, you know, we were hit with the COVID thing, so it was a very disjointed season, and that certainly didn't happen, because again, it doesn't happen, you're trying to get to know lads, but look, you know, you just have to, it's difficult when you're going into a different club, because you have to roll with the punches a little bit more. When I was over Cross, I knew these guys inside out since they were small, played with a lot of them, and I think in a sense, it made it easier, and then in another way, you know, as I always say, you know, when you go into a club, you're hugely popular for probably the first 2-3 months until you name your first team, and then that's when the battles start. Not only with players and that, but in your own head and your own mind then as well, because you're hoping that, you know, those little tweaks and changes that you've made, or a guy who's been playing for 10 years and all of a sudden maybe he's not part of your sort of plans in your head, and you know that's when the difficulties come. So everything is brilliant when you actually pick a team.
So the lads who don't make the 24, they hate you anyway, right? They absolutely hate you. The lads who are between number 16 and number 24 think you haven't a clue how you cannot pick them. Five of the starting team after a couple of months. You know, they're there, they're hanging on, they're fairly convinced. There are 10 lads probably have bought in, and then there's five who just, and they're wary of you. Is that right?
Only five.
that'd be pretty much how it goes, I imagine, most clubs, yeah.
And do you have rules? When you walked into Cross, did you say, here's my rules? When you walked into Inniskeen and say, here's my rules?
No, I wasn't. I didn't make it a dictatorship straight away. I introduced the rules so that people wouldn't really know there were rules as such, just things we needed to follow. But honestly, footballers are different now. I think there's the work ethic is there for, I think, for the vast majority of them, and any of them that don't have that work ethic are probably happy enough to play seconds or B football or reserve football or whatever it is. But I think the boys know now just how tuned in they need to be, and the fitness levels it takes to play at even you know, junior, intermediate, senior level with clubs.
Eamon, when you walked into the Kerry dressing room for the first time as manager, how'd you feel?
I can't remember now, Paul. I felt grand. I felt fine. I'd say we had a meeting similar to what Oisín was saying there. We had a meeting and we had a chat about, you know, we'd made some changes from the previous year and some things that we were going to try and do, and just looking forward to getting going, really. I probably spoke to a lot of the players individually before that first meeting anyway, and I was just looking forward to getting going, really.
Did you set down rules?
No, I didn't. I think probably like any team you're involved in, there were standards that we expected, all right. But to be fair, at that level, you know, they're pretty much in place anyway. And as the years are going on, maybe there was different things we did differently and higher expectations and higher standards and so on. But no, there was no need for any rules per se, no.
And is this something that you thought you would do? Like, when did you decide that you would be a manager? Is this something that was in your head through your playing career?
No, not at all. I would have always been involved with school teams from the day I started teaching. I was always involved in school teams, and I enjoyed that. But no, I never had management in my head at all. The only when it started to come into my head was I got a phone call from Jack O'Connor in whenever, maybe October, November 2008, when he came back as manager of Kerry to know if I'd like to be involved as a selector. And I'd only retired myself during the league, at the end of the league in 2007. So that was kind of a question in my head. Would I go back that soon into a dressing room where I knew so many of the lads and was good friends with a lot of them, to go back in at the other side of the table? And I said, look, if it was going to be a fantastic opportunity for me and I was going to get a great chance to learn off Jack at that level, and if it was something that was for me, then I'd have had a good apprenticeship under my belt. And I could also see maybe it wasn't something that was for me. So I enjoyed those couple of years with Jack, and it kind of went from there then.
Jack O'Connor in his book spoke about how every so often it was important to put a bomb under a team. And I think what he meant by that was that, you know, you drop someone, even if they don't absolutely necessarily deserve it, but you just shake it up. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it can have its impact, all right. But the way I approached it was I based it purely on form and, training form came into it, and obviously the form in the matches, and it didn't matter who you were or what you had done previously. If you weren't playing at the level that we expected, you weren't going to be picked. And I think it took a while for the lads to get used to that, because there probably was an expectation among some of the lads that they'd play no matter what and that they'd always produce it on the big day. But when they saw that it was a very consistent approach across the board with all of them, everyone bought into it then, and it kind of, it's a double-edged sword. It creates a spirit in a group that there's an opportunity there for everyone. But, with everyone looking over their shoulder, then sometimes you'd wonder about that as well, if it does create a bit of an edge that isn't helpful. So it's probably a balancing act. But I get what Jack was saying there, and he was a good man to do that every now and again as well.
What do you think the biggest mistake he made as manager of Kerry was?
Oh, the biggest mistake I made. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. There's things that I would have done differently now if I was back there now. I think as a manager, the things that you think about always are the big games that you lost, and selection decisions, personnel decisions that you think back about them. But I'm always pretty good at putting those things to rest, that, you know, you're there in a big day, you're trying to do your best, you make decisions. When they work, everything goes according to plan. When they don't work, you've made the decisions and the best of fate, and you just accept it's part of sport. Probably those things, there isn't too much I'd change about it in terms of the way we approach things or training regimes or, you know, backroom and management teams. There's nothing I'd change about it really. But, you know, you think about those big games that we lost, particularly very tight games, and you'd wonder, if I had done this or if we had done this, could it have changed the result? And I think the nature of sport is always, it is the decision you didn't make when you lose. It is the player you didn't bring on. It is the player you took off but shouldn't have taken off. And, you know, that's the great what-ifs of sport.
Did you do anything as a manager that you thought, before you went in, I'm never going to do that?
I don't think so. No, I think that I would have had... I would have had, you know, strong beliefs about things that I was going to do, and I would have followed through with them. Not really, Oisín. No, I don't think so.
No, because I was just thinking one of the things that I used to frown upon from the sidelines or in the stand was putting somebody on and taking them back off again. And I said, swore to myself that I'd never do that. But I've done it a couple of times since I got into management, and still doesn't sit well with me. But it, you know, you talk about when you go into management, you have your set of principles and you're going to stick to them. Yeah, well, I always go back to Manny McLean when he first took over Cavan, and he did an interview and he said, listen, we're not into defensive football. We're going to play open, expansive football. And we're going to, we're in Division 1 at the time, and we're going to play football the way it was meant to play. That lasted for, I was in Breffni Park, and it lasted for about 25 minutes. and all I could see was pandemonium on the sideline. When it came out in the second half, it was literally 15 players getting the ball just to see could they quell the Dubs or keep the Dubs at bay. So, there's, I suppose when it comes to management, there's lots, like I would have plenty of principles going into it, but sometimes those principles go out the window pretty sharp.
Absolutely, and I was never too principled about things like that. But the one thing that I just, as you were talking, similar probably to Matty McLean in there, the one thing that would have taken me a bit by surprise, and even the fact that I would have been involved as a selector, was just the level that management teams are at in Division One and across the country in all the divisions in terms of their decision making, in terms of the way they react during games. You make a change, they make a change, you make a change, they make a change. And I think I underestimated that prior to getting involved. But then when you're on the sideline and you're going toe to toe with the opposing management teams, that you do see that people are at a serious level, and you just appreciate it. I think you appreciate it more, and it was something that I probably underestimated prior to getting involved in that level myself.
I think a great example of planning before a game coming off, even if it wasn't ultimately successful, is the 2016 semi-final when you went after Stephen Cluxton's kick-out. 2-4 without reply came from it, 4 turnovers in an 8-minute spell. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was, when you talk about things that you planned beforehand, that was one of the most enjoyable things during my time in charge that we were involved in. That we worked constantly on that kick out, basically pushing everyone up. We kept 2 backs in place in our side of the field and pushing everyone up, playing 2 banks to 4 in the half forward line, the full forward line. We 2 of our half back line in the half forward line for those kickouts. We 3 big men across the field with Anthony Maher, David Moore, and Kieran Donaghy. And we just felt that we'd surprise the Dubs with that aggressive an approach.
Who came up with the idea?
Who came up with the idea? The idea, I suppose I drove the idea, and where the initial conversation would have taken place is with a conversation between myself and Kieran Donaghy around the way that sometimes teams in Australian rules approach the opposition restart, the opposition kick out. And I went away then and I thought about it and how you could apply that to the Gaelic football context. And it went from there, and we just started working on it night after night in training. We spent 10-15 minutes at it every single night, and it became a huge thing within the group, of spirit, a spirit thing, an excitement thing. The players, I know the physios used to be saying to me, geez, the lads were in and they were buzzing about this kick out. They were talking about it constantly while they were inside getting their treatment. And if you do this and I'll do that. And it was just a very exciting thing at the time. And we knew that we were going to get success off it. And when we got the Darren O'Sullivan got the goal in particular, you could see it gave the whole team energy. It just went through the whole team because we had tried one earlier in the half that didn't come off. Cluxton went long and Connolly got a flick in it, and they managed to get the kick out away. So, you know, the players might have been questioning, I wonder now, will we get it? And in fairness, they nailed it and we got the goal off it. And then, like you said, we had that spell where we kept them pinned in. But again, we might have been better off if it happened just after halftime rather than just before halftime, because they, you know, again, they came up with solutions. And in the second half, as it happened, we needed a free a shot at the goals to get it set. And I think we only got one free in the second half.
Yeah,
and they actually got that one over the top to Connolly as well, but they didn't get a score off it. But yeah, it was brilliant. It was an excellent thing from a coaching perspective that this idea came to us. We went away, thought about it, we tweaked it every night at training, and it was ready for the big day. And it worked in the big day, but unfortunately, it didn't. We didn't win.
It's interesting that you know Kieran Donaghy's input in that. Would you take much input from players on either ideas of how you would approach a game, how you would target an opposition, or who should actually be on your own team?
Who should be on my own team? But I would take input certainly about more or less everything else. But no, I wouldn't with regard to team selections and squad selections. I always felt that was a management job, and you know the players had to do the playing. Different maybe at club level where you might have senior players inputting into your decision making, like, but no, not at intercounty level. But with regard to everything else, absolutely. If they had ideas around you know, a tactical thing like that, or around opposition, or around particular players in opposition, because oftentimes the players know the opposition so much better. They've played in college with and against them, you know, they've great knowledge of them. And one of the things that we used to, and I always was blown away by the players' knowledge, was when we used to player-led video analysis. And if the players were doing a particular, you know, opposition or a particular aspect of the opposition, the material they used to bring back and in the meetings, it would blow your mind, their level of knowledge. So huge input with regards to that. And, you know, like I said, an initial discussion with Kieran, and I go away and think about it and working on it with the management then, and we come back with our own version of it then. But I think the more people that are feeding into it, the better.
Oisín, what about feedback from players, influence of players, advice from players? Did you try and influence a manager when you were playing?
No. I was one of those players who just basically got on with it, just wanted to play. Very rarely will I have a proper chat with managers unless it was around discipline. Generally speaking, I would take whatever on board. But again, it depends on the individual that's playing the information, and whether you take that on board or not. As far as influence, who starts or who's in the squad, just like Eamon said, that I wouldn't be influenced at all, even at club level, on any of that stuff. I mean, I think you're getting into dodgy ground if you start to be influenced in that way. But as far as ideas go, and again, you know, opposition nuances of different players and stuff, definitely take all of that stuff on board, but not as far as squad or team would be concerned.
In every team, there's obviously a huge range of personalities within a team, and particularly at inter-county level, there is a difference in profile of certain players as against others. How do you manage that idea of a star player?
I I think in general the star players are very easy to manage because they're driven. They bring very high standards themselves. You know, there's times when you star players have to be dropped and left out, and they mightn't be the happiest about it. But at the same time, generally they'll understand why it's happening. In my experience in general, Paul, they were I found guys like that easy enough to manage. And like you said, I think you've a broad spectrum of people you're dealing with in terms of their personalities, in terms of where they are in their playing career, in terms of where they are in their personal lives, in terms of where they are with regard to their college or work and so on. So I think you treat everyone as an individual. And again, it's probably part of the management side of things that you're trying to, you know, build those relationships, and you're trying to treat everyone as that individual and try to help them out off the pitch as much as you can. And it'll help them, and ultimately it'll help you on the pitch as well.
There's a little thing I actually do with professional teams when I talk about, it's just a little slide I have when I talk about the different characters in the change room. So you have the joker, you have the alpha male, a mixture of both, then you have the pro. So there's lots of different characters, there's lots of different people. In fact, some people can fit into almost all of them sometimes. And then you have the situation where person who thinks they're the alpha, but they're not really. Person who wants to be the alpha, but will never be the alpha. And then the guy who's pretty unassuming about the whole thing, but he's basically running the dressing room. He doesn't even know it. That sort of way. So there's lots of different things. And then, of course, there's the joker. And on the face of it, like Eamon talks about, you know, knowing your players, know what's going on in the background, knowing if there's any issues and different things. You got a lot of time, you know, not all the time, but a lot of time there's the guy who walks into the change rooms and, you know, is having a laugh, and that could that might not necessarily be their nature. I remember being on a golf outing with Benny Tierney and his wife, and anybody who knows Benny, and my wife, after about an hour, I think it was probably only the second time she met him, but after an hour, she turned to Benny's wife and she said, "Jesus, he must be an absolute depression in the house, is he? Because he never shuts his mouth when he's out." And she says, "No, worse, he's like this all the time." So there is characters like that who are just an absolute guy, but it's trying to figure out who's who in the change room and trying to figure out, you know, how you make that work for you and get the best out of players as a result of that, you know.
The only way to do that is time, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, if you're not even allowed into the change rooms at the minute, like I say, I've been in a club and I think we've been in the change room once for that initial meeting, and we haven't been in it since. So that's a big piece of the jigsaw that's missing for a lot of teams. And when people talk about closing the gap with the Dubs, that's an essential part of it. Even lads hanging about and getting a bit of food and different things after training and all those sort of things. It's all of those little things, especially if you're a new manager, and there's a lot of new managers, especially in the Galactico Division 4 now.
Which we're going to talk about in the next couple of weeks, because it's the place to be.
So, yeah, so I suppose that's another piece of the jigsaw that's missing as far as, you know, getting into change rooms and really getting to know boys' characters, you know.
Is it more of an issue at a club team? Have you been in a position with a club team where you have to, or you've made a decision basically to indulge somebody because you need them?
I wouldn't say that, but...
Made compromises. We'll put it differently. You've made compromises in your principles to include someone.
If I feel they're meeting me somewhere along the road, then yeah. But I have had situations where I thought from afar, looking in and going, they just don't know how to manage that lad, you know. And I'll go in there and it'll be different with me. A couple of months down the lane, it's not that different. And that's something that, you know, I struggled to get my head around initially. But, you know, the guy who people warn you before you go into the club and different things like that, and you go in there and you say, "Nah, it'll be different under me." And it's not that much different.
And when you're trying to set up a team, what are you looking for? What are you trying to do? What's the first thing you're trying to do?
Well, I think the first thing that I would be trying to do, what I would do is, I would first of all, have a look at the players that I have, and then seeing the system that I was going to implement, if we would have the wherewithal in order to do that. It was pretty simple at Cross. So Cross wasn't really that much of a learning curve for me, because we wanted to play in a certain way, and we probably had the players to play in that certain way. And I actually think, funny, looking across now is something that probably has hurt us, because, you know, people want to see us playing a certain way. They expect us to play a certain way. I don't know if we have the players to play that way anymore. So it probably wasn't that. It was only when maybe I started doing a bit of college, and then obviously went to different clubs, have been with Central Town and Meath, and then on to Enniskeen. And the thing about you know, having a way of playing, it can be a very general way of playing, and then tweak it in order to suit the individuals that you have. But not to give away all my secrets, but try and get the ball to the players that are going to hurt. They're going to hurt the opposition as quickly and as often as you possibly can. And obviously, there's a manager on the other side who doesn't want that to happen, and is trying to overpower that. And one thing that I would say happened us last year was I thought I was going to keep things a bit tighter at the back, and I think in the first half of the county semi-final, we conceded maybe 2-10 or 2-11. You know, so you know, just times where things are getting away from you. You know, but it's just to have that, I suppose, to have as general a principle as possible, and not be too rigid with it.
Eamon, what's the thing you look for most?
Yeah, I'd agree with Oisín there, Paul. I think it depends on the players you have, and you know, you're going to have your basic principles that when you're on the ball, you're going to want to play a certain way. You're going to want the accuracy at a certain level. I always like teams to kick the ball when you can. Without the ball, you're going to have the basic principle of working very hard as a collective to try and get the ball back as quickly as possible. But after that, then, in terms of the nuances and the real detail of it, it depends on the type of players you have, and to be flexible. That, you know, depending on the opposition, depending on the players that you have, some days, you were saying about indulging players earlier, sometimes you have to indulge players. You've injuries, you fellas out, you fellas suspended, you're down to the bare bones, everyone has to play, and the fella who mightn't be, you mightn't be on his Christmas card list, suddenly he's the most important player on the field for a given day. So you have to try and come around him then and convince him that he is that important and to play for the jersey and to play for you. So, you know, it's all dependent on that flexibility then, and depending on working on what you're dealt with on a particular day.
Before we finish, can I ask you, do you wish you were still playing?
I do.
So Easter Saturday, it was such a beautiful day, Easter Saturday. It was lovely and warm. There was kind of that smell of cut grass around the place. The ground's firming up, and there's a ball on the lawn, and, you know, there's a bit of Christmas in the grass. Do you think of going back? Have you got yourself in shape to go back?
Shape to go back now and wanting to go back are two different things.
How old are you now?
I'm 43.
So you could still play club football?
I could, but nah. I'd love the idea of it, Paul. I'd love the idea of going back and playing, absolutely. But no, I'd be too frustrated with what I couldn't do. And I think, secondly, I just think the body, I was very lucky with injuries all through my career, and I've no huge ailments or issues now. And I think if I went back, I'd be breaking down and I'd have injuries, and I just have no patience for that. So when the smell of cut grass and the crisp and the ball is lying there and the romantic notion comes into your thing, I think about 20 seconds later, it's gone out the other side. And I just have to say no. But yeah, I do love the idea of it, and it would be nice to go back and play. And if I felt the body wouldn't be breaking down, I'd love it. But no,
Oisín.
I would have felt at the time that I stopped playing that I could have probably played another year or two, but I was 38, and could I play today? No, because I kicked the ball about for a couple of hours with the boys and on Friday and Saturday, and aches and pains, and then we went on the bike yesterday for an hour, and honestly couldn't walk last night. I had to literally roll off the sofa in order to get upstairs, but. I would have finished my career with a few different ailments, and they haven't been too bad. But I know as soon as I go back in the pitch, I probably could get away with playing one game, and then no, it would all end very, very badly for me.
But you're 48 or 9 now. Is that right?
Ouch. You can see by my long flowing locks that I'm still only. I'm 45 now. 46 this year. I know I don't look it, especially about a haircut.
And there's nothing left in the tank. There's no way. There's no. You won't stand in nothing. How are your skills when you're kicking around with the lads? How are they holding up?
Yeah, the skills are still different gravy. Like, but no, you
love it.
Your kids going to be cornerbacks, are they?
You don't lose any of that stuff. I suppose one thing I used to do with some of the lads when I arrived at training was, and not to be recommended, but if we were trying to kick the ball over from the sideline. I just noticed that, you know, initially it was grand, and then all of a sudden just gets a little bit shorter and a little bit shorter and a little bit shorter. And now you're just one in on the square for Big Donaghy, really. That's the best you can hope for, you know.
Yeah. Play the crossbar challenge with them now, Oisín. It's a bit heavier.
Yeah, too much. I refuse to kick anything except a size 4 football now. There's no point in going with the big one. I want to finish up by thanking Larry for running the podcast, and to Tony and everyone at the Examiner for making it happen. Huge thanks to Eamon and to Oisín for coming along today. So happy Easter to everyone, and we look forward to talking to you soon. Thank you.
A grain of rice is going to tip the scale. Just remember that, lad.
There's a small bit of a needle there.
Now, come on, Mayo. You've got to get Andy Moran into the game.
Listen, back to England.